It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It's been said that one book can change a life. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush, and that is the theme of the Salisbury Book Festival that kicks off this month. Indeed, one study found that having books in the home is twice as important as a father's education level. And if anyone was more aware of the importance of childhood reading, it was Ernie Bond, a children's literature professor at Salisbury University, a key figure in the annual Young Children's and Young Adult Literature Festival. He died earlier this year and has inspired this year's activities. In the studio to take a look at what is being done here in Waucomico County, the significance of childhood literacy, we have Andrea Bursler. She is the executive director of the Waucomico County Library. Also, Ruth Malone, director of curriculum and professional development with the Waucomico Public Schools, and Dave Hanlon, who headed up a literacy task force in Hagerstown. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Dave, I want to start with you. I mentioned a moment ago that just the presence of books inside a home has a tremendous impact on children. And that's struck a little home for me because I can remember lots of books in my home, even though my parents weren't particularly big readers. I vaguely remember them say, reading to me a bit, but nonetheless, both my brother and I, voracious readers, we pick something up from just simply the presence of books.
Exactly. Books are a great practice tool for young children. To me, language is really and is part of a process of brain development in young children. Research has shown that a child by the age of eight is either reading on grade level or not, and if they're not, they're probably going to struggle the rest of their lives. They will not necessarily perform well in school, and they will struggle in their careers moving forward. And now the state of Maryland has figured out a way to measure child's readiness at kindergarten level. And that's a good indicator about whether they're going to be able to read by age eight and to third grade. Language is critical. It's a key, obviously, to success in school and life. Language acquisition, the mere process of learning to read, learning, having an adult or a surrogate parent teach you words, has a social component to it. That's critical for developing a thing called social-emotional concepts. And if a child can read fiction, fiction does tremendously good, great work for young children and early childhood and up through age eight for developing empathy. We have a lot of lack of empathy in this country, and it correlates very highly with a reduction in reading of fiction. And the other critical thing that I am beginning to focus on more and more is the role of language and literacy and how a child interacts with other children in school. They sort of develop a little idea of their pecking order, their place. Are they going to be successful or not? And by, again, getting back to that critical age eight, that's when a child understands where they are in the world and their aspirations, where they're likely to end up. It's something, maybe they can't articulate it, but they have an idea. And so it all boils down to getting that language and literacy component in a child's brain developed so they can be successful in life.
Because one of the things I ran across is that apparently the greatest growth in terms of brain development is like from birth to about 5 years of age. 85% of the brain's core is formed by the age of three. And yet we don't really begin to teach people how to read until five if they haven't had their parents. I mean, what about that? I mean, are we lucky that we made it the ability to read?
Well, scientists, you're right. Scientists have had some major breakthroughs using some of these advanced medical techniques now to image brains, and they can actually visualize children who are successful in that development of certain core bodies. Not to throw off technical terms, but Broxia and Wernicke's bodies are critical to language acquisition and language communication. And if those aren't developed by age five, that child's going to struggle in not only acquiring new words, but also being able to vocalize those words.
So what do you think is the key to teaching kids how to read? Is it just simply, I mean, obviously books is great. Is it important for them to also be read? Because there are a lot of homes, for instance, and certainly probably even more increasingly now, where you don't see any books at all. And of course, now we have this electronic age in which all we got are the little tablets if we're reading something, or we're just fixed to these little devices. What about that?
It's the time of the parent or the surrogate parent. Can the parent sit and take a few minutes and read with a child so and show a child how words are pronounced, to show a child what words look like? If a child can go through some of those basic things and then practice with that child, that the parent a little bit, the child can often go off and read on their own. You can't just throw a book at a child and say, here, read this. What is this?
Right.
They need some instruction, and the parent is the first step to do that.
And if they find out that they don't like to read or they struggle with reading, what happens to the children? What's the prognosis then?
Hopefully the parent will see there's a problem, get them into pre-K or some sort of a preschool program, and the school system will identify them quickly and do some intervention techniques with the child, and hopefully be able to move some of the children who are sort of marginal up into where they're really successful.
That's funny. In terms of exposure, a couple of things I ran across is that, for instance, children of professional families, they are usually exposed about 215,000 words per week. Working families, it's only 125,000, and folks who are on public assistance, it's about 62,000. There seems to be an economic component to how well or how quickly a child reads. It's not that children who are in poor areas or poor families can't learn to read and read well, but it seems to me there's an economic dynamic here.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, parents, we're now at a point where we've had several generations since the 60s, when a lot of things began to happen in our society that caused put a lot of pressure on families. But parents who have been raised in poverty, or children or parents who've been raised in situations where they don't have the language skills, they have a really hard time. They don't know. They don't know what they don't know. And it's hard to pass along. If you only got a vocabulary of maybe 4,000 or 5,000 words, to pass along enough language to be where you or I might be 15,000 to 20,000 words. It's hard for a parent who's an adult who's only got so few words in their vocabulary lexicon to be able to teach a child. Has to start someplace.
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, that brings me to the next issue, which, of course, is education. That's like the first blush where if you haven't had any instruction at all, this is where it happens. Ruth Malone, you're Director of Curriculum and Professional Development at Wacomico Public Schools. How do you deal with the fact that, yes, you're going to get some children who really read well, and that's great, but you're going to get a section of the population, a section of the children where they don't do so well?
Well, it certainly is a challenge, and it's one that the school system takes very, very seriously, and it's certainly at the core of our mission. A student who can't read really can't function in today's society. And so our role is to take those students who do read well and make sure that we're accelerating that and giving them lots of chances to enrich and enhance those reading skills. For those students who are struggling, we need to intervene. We do intervene with a variety of programs that are research-based, but at the same time, we can't simply do that. We have to connect those students with that which they're interested, that which are their interests, and at the same time, give them access to grade-level text. And it certainly is a challenge. We have put a lot of resources in the school system to deal with early literacy, reading intervention across the grade levels, because we can't simply say, well, you didn't get it by grade 3, we're really sorry. We have to continue to intervene and continue to give support to those students who are struggling to read. We do that with a program called Leveled Literacy Intervention. Again, it's research-based, and it is involved with small class sizes with teachers who are reading interventionists, who understand the reading process, who can diagnose the area where a student may be struggling, and can prescribe specific strategies to address that particular issue. It's hard work, it's time-consuming work, and many times the success comes in very small steps, but those successes are so critical to a student being able to be a successful citizen in our community.
So what is it that, do you identify particular students who say, for instance, have problems? And how do you sort that out? Because obviously there are going to be some folks who actually they read well, right? But how do you figure out who doesn't?
We have a variety of assessments. We have a reading assessment that gives a score called a Lexile level, which suggests where, in a broad range, where that student is reading. But at the same time, we also lean on observational data from teachers who may notice that a student is experiencing difficulty with comprehension. Or maybe they're understanding what they're reading, but they're having difficulty expressing that comprehension. So that's a different kind of struggle. We lean on the professional judgment of our teachers in our classrooms each and every day. And then we back that up with reading assessments, the state assessments that give us a good picture and a comprehensive picture about how a student is reading and whether they're reading well in fiction, but they struggle with informational text, or whether they understand text when it's combined with pictures, but they need that support of pictures, or whether they really just enjoy fiction.
Do you have any sense, by the way, in terms of numbers as to how many children come into your school system that are not proficient or may be illiterate? I don't know whether you have any of those or
well,
not.
Well, it's a daunting statistic. We have over 50% of the students that arrive in our kindergarten classes are functioning below what we would expect, or they're not quite ready for the demands, the academic demands of school. And that's a daunting number. And it really goes to the point of a community effort to focus in on literacy and to focus in on early literacy. Because if we can intervene early, if we can give them the skills and the strategies early, they'll be an on-grade level reader by the time they hit that fourth grade text. And so our efforts with young readers really is crucial to our success as a school system, but more broadly, our success as a community.
And how about in terms of involvement of the parents? I mean, how do you reach out to them? Because I'm sure that a lot of them, particularly those who don't perform well, probably have parents who already have one job, if not two. There's a whole set of economic pressures that impinge on those parents who might say today, say, gee, I'd love to sit down and read to my kid, but I got two jobs, or I'm really tired, or I got these other things I got to do.
And that's certainly a very valid point. Role model at home is really the best thing that we can have. A parent who can sit down and read with a child for even 5 minutes. That's 5 minutes more than they would have had. Or giving them the opportunity and books in the home so that maybe the child can read to the family dog. Dogs are wonderful companions, and they don't really make any fun of you if you make a mistake as you're reading. So being a role model, providing those books in the home, or just asking questions when a child comes home from school. What did you read today? What did you like about what you read today? Can you show me what you read today? And asking those questions, even if for a very short time, certainly helps. We know that those skills begin at home, and that's why it needs to be a community effort.
So, Andrea, you are have the repository of books, of every book we ever want, right?
We will find it for you, yes.
That's right. But I mean, I can remember as a young man, a student, going into the large, at least they seemed large at the time, libraries. At the time, of course, they had the wooden shelves. I guess we now have metal shelves,
yes,
and so on, and certainly no internet. How do you interface with students and with people who come in, particularly young children, in terms of how you get them to read? You have programs. What's the approach that you guys take?
We do, and to be honest, libraries were one of the first. They were really on the leading edge of this early literacy piece. We've been doing this for years. The story times that we do with children, they seem like a lot of fun, and they are, and they seem like sort of a fluff piece, and they're not. They are a forum. They are a platform to engage students in a love of reading, to demonstrate to them and to their parents how you engage in reading, not just sitting down and reading with your student the 10 or 15 minutes. 15 minutes a day is the magic number. If you can read with your student 15 minutes a day, you can change their reading levels. But then beyond sitting there with them and reading a book with them, having them sit on your lap, is the other things you do around vocabulary and literacy, as Dave alluded to, where that maybe you read a book about, say, another country, and you talk about, well, maybe we can make a meal from that country. Let's go find out what kind of food, or let's find out what kind of clothing they wear, and let's make a costume like that. It's all the additional activities that demonstrate to them how you engage in the vocabulary and the story and the plot and the characters. It's all the components of reading that help children to learn to use words and learn to string them together into sentences and communicate with them. That's why we have some students who can take things in but cannot put them back out because no one has engaged with them in vocabulary. So our librarians conduct a slew of story times every month, and they're for all sorts of ages from birth to second grade. Again, trying to intervene before that third grade magic time. And we show, we have baby lap sits, and we encourage parents and caregivers, bring your children in, engage in books, engage in reading. Let us show you how this is done. We have a special place in the library that's birth to five, and it's all sorts of toys and all sorts of puppets and books where the parents can come in and they can, if they don't have a place and they don't have money and they don't have even the knowledge of how to do this, it's all there for them. And our librarians will help them use those things so that their children can learn, yeah, reading is fun. Look, we can read this book and we can pretend to travel to, you know, Japan. We can pretend to travel to Africa. We can pretend to travel to the North Pole or another country. But beyond that, look at all the other things we can do. We can make a play and we can take these puppets. And so children who don't love to read often have had not had these additional engagement experiences to show them the broadness of what they're reading and how that they can interact with it. So that's really an awful lot of what we do there. Then we run into the adults, of course, who have been through this and they didn't get these skills for whatever reason. And we have a whole program called Project Read where we engage with them and teach them these life skills that they're missing and that cause them all kinds of issues here as adults in getting a job and being able to acquire new skills and being able to improve their lives. So we sort of get both sides of what the school's doing. We try and help before they get to kindergarten. We have homework help. We do all sorts of things while they're in school, but then we really focus again on intervening for adults and working with them.
What is the difference? I mean, I guess they're obvious, but what is the difference in terms of approach of for somebody who, say, who is a child is just beginning to learn, right, as opposed to an adult who obviously, I mean, we all say that, you know, if you want to learn a foreign language, you do it early because it's much more difficult later on, right? I mean, for a lot of folks, and I've known one particular person who was illiterate, and when they, for instance, got instructions to drive down the road, well, they had to look at each letter on the sign. They couldn't just read the sign, right? They could easily bypass it before they get to the end, right? So this process is much different. How do you contrast the two approaches you take?
It truly is different. With children, the brain synapses are still being formed. There's an awful lot of ability to take in new information that we lose as adults. New information becomes more difficult to acquire. We often joke that, you know, your brain gets full and there's no more room. But in reality, it's that the synapses and the learning style have been set. So with children, we can take a group of children and we can work, you know, in the schools, you can work with groups of children. When it gets to working with an adult, it really becomes a one-on-one venture. And you have to discover what is that adult's established learning structure. What is the process they've developed to take in new information? And then you have to design a curriculum that parallels that structure. So if they're like the individual that you described, where that they understand letters, you start working at that piece, and then you discover with them, okay, how are we processing those letters? How am I figuring out what those letters mean? And you begin to teach them using that process. But with someone else, it may be something different. It may be a learning disability. Maybe they have dyslexia or something else, and you have to create a completely different process for them. And so teaching adults is a very labor intensive, and really the only way to be successful with that is one-on-one. But with kids, it's a whole different thing. And you know, we kind of take icing and we make it all fun, but there's a lot of meat that goes on in those early learning.
Dave, just briefly, I wanted to touch on the idea about children and reading problems like dyslexia, for instance. How does one overcome one? I mean, how do you spot that, and how do you overcome that kind of problem?
Oh, I think you're getting into a diagnostic topic here. I'm not
but obviously you run into that, right?
Yes, we do run into that. There is a certain percentage of the population is going to have a disability, a learning disability of some kind. Some of them will be able to perform it at a non-grade level, some will not. In terms of diagnosing that, that's really the role of the parent watching their child, being close to their child. And I think the medical community has a big role to play in that. Back in Washington County, we started a program through our pediatricians to encourage them to be aware and to refer people to resources in the community for their three-year-old who was struggling.
So I want to turn, by the way, to events. I mean, apparently Andrea, I'm going to kick it to you in terms of events in the year, because I mean, I guess you've had something at the zoo, and you're going to have a Breeze for Wellness and so on. What's going on in terms of the events that you're trying to have here?
This slate of events is really an organizational partnership between the Board of Ed and the City of Salisbury and the library, and there's about 15 organizations. The event that was supposed to be at the zoo last night has been moved to the 13th because of the weather. So tonight's 5K will be the kickoff event for the Salisbury Book Festival. It's the Wellness Committee at the Board of Ed started this, and it's a 5K for wellness and literacy. It's a race, and there's a 1K walk, and it's around the city park. It starts at Ben's Red Swings, and there will be prizes, and there will be food, and T-shirts and all the things that accompany a very good 5K. Next week, then, will be the Wild About reading at the zoo. Kids can come. They read books. They engage with the animals. They do crafts. All those engagement pieces that I mentioned before, the zoo is incorporating them into this event. And again, the idea is to show them how much fun reading is. Then we have the Literacy Breakfast, the Light of Literacy Awards, April 20th. That also kicks off the Salisbury Book Drive, which is in honor of Ernie Bond and all of his work with children's literacy. The 22nd is the Literature Festival at SU, which was Ernie's signature event. In May, we have a Salisbury One Reads, where we're asking the community to all read the book The Underground Railroad and discuss that and talk about the concepts that are going on in there. And then finally, on May 20th, we have a block party downtown to celebrate the success of the event. It'll be the finale of the book drive. We have performers coming, and we have food trucks, and we've got celebrity readers and mascots and all kinds of things going on during the day. And again, it's so parents will come down, see how kids can engage with reading, see how much fun it can be. It's not something that you have to do because it's homework. There's a lot of fun that can be had around stories.
Let me finally ask you, we mentioned motive of Ernie Bond. Andrea, how important was he to this community and to children's literature?
Oh, I do not have the time to describe Ernie's impact. I don't think most of the people in this community understand that he was a worldwide expert in children's literature and the value of the authors he was able to bring to the community and engage those authors with students and with potential writers and with their readers. There's nothing more magical than to watch an author and a reader get together and discuss a story. And that's what Ernie created every year. This year's Literature Festival, from what I understand, is going to be the best one. They have 10 authors coming and all sorts of really great events. They've sort of poured their heart and soul in this as a tribute to Ernie. But his impact in this particular field and the loss of him as an expert will be felt for years.
I know we've had him on a number of times on the annual. He was such an ebullient, outgoing, always with a smile kind of guy, and he certainly will be missed. We've been talking with Andrea Bursler. She's the executive director of the Guacamayo County Library. Also, Ruth Malone, director of curriculum and professional development with the Guacamayo Public Schools, and Dave Hanlon, who headed up a literacy task force in Hagerstown. We appreciate you all stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Harriet Tubman is an iconic figure on the Eastern Shore. Now the former slave and abolitionist is being celebrated with a new visitor center next to the Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Harriet Tubman was born in slavery sometime around 1822. In Dorchester County, she suffered a traumatic head injury from a beating she received at the hands of an irate slave owner. In 1849, she eventually escaped to Philadelphia. She subsequently went back to Maryland to rescue her family and eventually led dozens of other slaves to freedom. She was nicknamed Moses and brought out as many as 70 slaves, including some of her family, as a conductor on the Underground Railroad. She eventually worked for the Union Army during the Civil War, and in later years, she became involved with the women's suffrage movement. She died in 1913. By phone this morning, we have Kate Larson. She is author of Bound for the Promised Land, Portrait of an American Hero. Also, Tina Wyatt. She is a descendant of Harriet Tubman. And in our studio is Dana Patera, Maryland State Park Manager, overseeing the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Visitor Center. So I want to start really with Kate. And give me a sense about the importance that Tubman had when it comes to her own revelation of having to escape from slavery, but then having escaped, constantly returning to bring other slaves out.
I think that we can't underestimate how courageous and important it was that Tubman actually did that. So there were people who escaped and fled to safety elsewhere, but rarely did they return to rescue other people. And that was mostly because it was so incredibly dangerous. And there were a few that did try. Sometimes they were caught. Sometimes they would just come back for one or two, you know, relatives. But Tubman is almost unique in that she returned so many times to bring away family and friends, the people that she loved the most.
Why was it, do you think, that she had that kind of passion to risk her own life, obviously, by coming back?
Well, she said herself that once she reached freedom in Philadelphia, freedom felt sort of hollow because everyone she loved was still back in Maryland and enslaved. So that was what drove her to try to rescue her family and friends. But there's something about Tubman, and I guess that's the elusiveness of trying to understand her, that she did go back, and so few people did that. So what was it about her that made her different? There were lots of courageous people out there, but there was something special about her, and I think we're always trying to figure that out and capture that, that made her different than most other people.
Did she indicate in her writings or in her, not writings, but certainly what she said, why she had this passion? Were there some rational reasons why? Or was there something emotive, something that this came from her gut?
I think it came from her gut, and it was this incredible passion for freedom. And frankly, she had conducted a war against slavery probably her whole life, even as a child. And this was just one more manifestation of her war on slavery, was to go back and battle that institution and the people who kept it going. And by doing that, she could rescue her family and friends.
Now, by the way, she, as I indicated a moment ago, she was the recipient of this head wound that seemed to traumatically create certainly not only problems in terms of her health, but also seemed to be connected to her visions, her religious beliefs. What happened there?
She received a horrific head wound that almost killed her when she was a young teenager. A weight from a dry goods store scale was thrown at her by an overseer who was intending to hit somebody else. And it cracked her skull, and she almost died from that. As a result, she ended up with an epileptic condition of some sort. She had deep faith. She was deeply spiritual. And after this injury, the seizures that she had created just situations that were not clear to her, and she didn't understand. She heard voices. She heard music. She felt that God spoke to her, and it gave her strength. And her connection to God was very real to her, and you know, who are we to say that it wasn't true? Because gosh, she really was protected, and God guided her as far as she was concerned, and that strong faith helped her through the darkest moments of her life, and certainly during her rescue missions.
Now, what was her connection then with her family? We indicated a moment ago that she came back to rescue some of them, but her husband, not so much. What were those connections?
So her husband was a free man born to a free family, and he did not want to leave his home. I think that's a basic story. We have to understand that and accept that. But Tubman's family was enslaved, and that was a very different situation for her. They were at risk to be sold, and for Upper South enslaved people to be sold to the Deep South was basically a death sentence. So she felt this urgency to rescue her family as quickly as possible. But she had to forget about John Tubman, her husband, because he was creating a new life with a free wife, you know, in Dorchester County, Maryland, without her.
Now, one of the remarkable things is that she could not read, and yet she was able to remember not only how to get from one place to another, but also then communicate that to others. How did she do that?
She was brilliant. She was a genius. We have to think of genius in a different way rather than someone who is lettered that could read and write. She had a remarkable brilliance about her, and she could read the landscape. She could, you know, she definitely understood the stars and how to map and guide herself by the stars. But there are many features on landscapes that she had learned growing up, and she used those to her advantage, and she could remember everything. So she just used that great mind of hers to find her way back and forth. And when she was in a situation that was unfamiliar to her, she just had this great ability to navigate out of really bad, scary situations.
So
she was just a genius.
So when she moves north, of course, she becomes part of the abolitionist movement. How did she relate to the other figures in that movement, for Douglas, for example, or even John Brown? How did she relate to them? How did that fit in?
She got to know some of the greatest abolitionists of the time, black and white. At first, she was very cautious. She was a very cautious person, you know, rightly so. But they were so impressed by her genius and her brilliance and her courage that they were very attracted to her, and she admired their willingness to go out there and fight to end slavery as well. And with a man like John Brown, you know, she almost could not believe that this man was willing to give up his life to end slavery, and she greatly admired John Brown. But there were many, many abolitionists that were just, you know, in awe of her ability to navigate back into slave territory and bring people away and survive. So there were many, many admirers of hers in the North.
By the way, what is her connection in terms of John Brown? I mean, I get the sense like she certainly was sympathetic, may have been semi-involved with the ideas about an uprising. How much do we know?
He met her in 1858 when she was living in Canada. He had been told to get in touch with her because she had this ability to navigate across quote-unquote enemy territory, and that she could help recruit people to be part of his provisional army to attack in the South. So that was a very real relationship. We don't know too much about it. We do know that he admired her greatly, and he called her General Tubman, and he felt that she was as great as any military leader that he had ever known or met. So they had a very strong bond, and she was supposed to be with him when he conducted his raid on Harper's Ferry, but she was apparently sick in New Bedford, Massachusetts at the time and did not join him, which is a good thing because she probably would have been captured and killed.
Did she see, as far as we know, did she see armed uprising, armed conflict, obviously prior to the Civil War, as an avenue? It sounds like she certainly thought about it in those terms.
Yeah, absolutely. I think she understood that there was no way that slavery was going to die on its own, that it had to be ended with force.
Well, Tina, I want to turn to you. You're a descendant of Harriet Tubman. How are you connected?
Well, one thing I want to do is thank you for having me on your show, but also to make a correction.
Sure.
The word descendant, meaning that I come directly from her, where she didn't have any children from her own body, but she did have an adopted child, which we don't know what happened to her. I'm a descendant of one of her siblings, and so that myself being the great-great-great-grandniece, my great-great-great-grandmother was in her, my great-great-grandmother, was on the census as being a six-year-old child in the home of her grandparents, Ritt and Ben at the time.
So in your family, how did you get to know the fact that you had this historic figure in your family? When did you become aware of it?
Well, I became aware of it it was always there, you know, and my mother, who was a member of the AME Zion Church. My mother comes from Auburn, and so do all the pretty much all the other relatives in her line. My maternal line lived in Auburn at one time. My mother moved from Auburn to Buffalo, and so she was a member of the AME Zion Church, which was the church that that Aunt Harriet became a member of in Auburn. And so we have a conference of the AME Zion Church in different regions. So we were in that region still when she came to Buffalo. The relationship with the church, between the church and between the family, wasn't one that was really a good one. So my mother was always trying to have a voice for the family, as some other members were, and that voice was not welcomed. But what happened during that time, my mother also very spiritual. I remember her, a picture of her with the bishop at that time, and then the presiding elder as well. And that was the last time there was a problem, a big problem at that time between that voice that they wanted the family to have regarding Aunt Harriet. And that was the last time. And that was what I remember the most about. That's when it came to to the forefront, where that relationship and who Aunt Harriet really was to us. But that's something that we never really, that I never talked about to other people, because the first time I ever did, it wasn't believed. So I learned very early not to share that relationship. But as far as knowing it, I always knew it. And periodically they would talk about different things. When we would go to Auburn, it was almost as if she were still alive. But okay, let's go to the home and let's visit, you know, Aunt Harriet, where she lived and things like that. So that was always a part of what we did in going there. And we were there every weekend, because we didn't live far from Auburn. We lived in Buffalo, so which is only about a two-hour ride. So my parents spent a lot of time there, as well as we did, and then summers the children. We spent a lot of time there during that time.
Did you ever get a sense that when you were there, of her own presence? I don't know whether it's spiritual or not, or just the fact that she was there, that you looked around, that this was where she had been?
Did I feel her presence?
Yeah.
Well, you know, as far as feeling her presence, it was a place. And I didn't really understand what that meant, her presence, until I became older. And then I began to read what she had dictated to in her book. And then after later reading Kate's book, what I found and became very present to me was how Aunt Harriet, who was really the hub of the family in Auburn, everything circled around her, all the family members, you know, circled around her, and she was the hub. And her beginning of the uplifting and caring and love, that kind of thing was instilled in, at least in my family line, to her, to my great-great grandmother, to my great-grandmother, and then to my grandmother, and then to my mother. That love of God, that love of helping other people and doing it without expecting anything back, but just doing it because that's what love does. That's what I became aware of, and that presence and that connection to her was for me and through my family. So I'm, you know, just well aware of that now, and where all of that comes from.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned a moment ago about a voice in terms of the family, in terms of Tubman. What did you mean by that? What was that about?
Just that, you know, that she did have a family that loved her, that she had a family that even during that time, although my mother didn't know her, my grandmother did, and then other people that were elderly at that time had a relationship with her, knew who she was, and knew what it was that she wanted, that legacy of continuing to help and uplift other people and do things like that. So that's what I mean, and recognizing that, okay, the family is here, you know, that she still has a connection through family.
Did you have a sense about what she was personally like in terms of what's been passed down from your family?
Oh, yes.
what was she like?
She was a woman of integrity, strength, courage, all those, you know, the words that people would use about her. But, you know, most of all, she was a woman of great faith and love. I know that, that, you know, in today's world that, you know, God is not important in a lot of people's lives, but for her, and it's not politically correct, but for her, God was important, and it was what she believed, and she believed in that love that he had. It didn't matter to her about other people and what they believed, but it was what God meant to her and was telling her to do, and through her, she was able to show the love of God that God has for all people, and she was able to bring that out and just shower other people with that love, and helping them, and she continued to do so. And I saw that same thing in my grandmother and in my own mother. My mother was a very sweet, sweet woman, but and she was also a very selfless woman, helping people and things like that. But she could also be a fierce woman if it was something that she truly believed in and felt that that someone was trying to hurt someone else, and that she would stand up for that and do what she could. Also, a spiritual woman wanting the love of God to be shown through her and on to other people.
On that note, turn to Kate for a moment, because she was very outspoken, and at one point, I guess it was during the Civil War, she was a very sharp critic of Lincoln, in the sense that she wrote before the Emancipation Proclamation, it says, "Master Lincoln, he's a great man, and I'm a poor Negro, but the Negro can tell Master Lincoln how to save the money and the young men. He can do it by setting the Negro free." Right. Was she always this outspoken, even to her allies?
Right, right. She was very demanding. She was on point. She never lost her focus. She was not going to compromise at all. She was very politically savvy. And when she spoke and when she said things like that, people listened to her. And that's sort of a remarkable thing, this formerly enslaved, little petite disabled woman with no education could hold the attention of some of the greatest minds of the day. And, you know, she called on them to take action and demanded that they act, and they did.
Dana Patera, I want to turn to you. You're Maryland State Park manager here of the Underground Railroad. Tell us a little bit about the exhibit, because as I understand it, it's not really a museum, but it's an exhibit. It's a center. Tell me a little bit about conceptually what it's about.
Correct, Don. When visitors arrive at the center, they can become inspired and learn more about her formative years in the Choptank River region. They can learn that Tubman was a conductor of the Underground Railroad, and the Underground Railroad actually brought her to national prominence. And they can also become inspired by her work as a freedom fighter, leader, liberator, and humanitarian.
Was there something like four buildings, as I understand, a set of buildings? How do those connect?
The design concept for the park on the 17 acres in Church Creek is the view north. And the exhibit building and the administration building are situated on a south to north access. And you enter into the state park on the southern end. And everything is based on this northward migration, exhibiting the idea that an enslaved person is bettering their circumstances by moving north. So the exhibit building itself is divided up into four pavilions. And the first pavilion is sited in cedar, which, as we all know, is very common on the Eastern Shore. And this first pavilion represents the present day. It has the museum store, the lobby, the restrooms, and the classroom. And then as you progress north, you enter into three pavilions that are sited in zinc. And this represents stepping back into Tubman's world. So you enter in to the southern end of the exhibit space in the zinc-sided pavilions, and it is dark and it is closed in. The hallways are sided with reclaimed barnwood that was locally sourced on the Eastern Shore. And as you make your way north through the exhibits, more natural light is allowed to filter in, and the ceiling is a little bit higher, and you just have this overall sense of uplifting and more positive feeling.
So what kinds of exhibits then are there? I mean, in terms of, I understand there's disguises, there's that she used sculpture and so on. What about those individual things?
The exhibits are very immersive and evocative. The first one that you encounter is basically an egg-shaped theater with a ceiling-mounted projector that displays images, historical images and landscape images, and song, and you hear song on the walls around you. And this really sets the stage for what you're about to experience through the rest of the exhibits. Because we don't have many architectural remains or structural remains from Tubman's time, we have our most important interpretive tool by far is the landscape itself. So we really want to emphasize the connection to Tubman's story to this landscape. And, you know, the Choptank River region, especially where we're located, is largely reminiscent of what it looked like during Tubman's time, even down to the land uses. The architecture, agricultural land is still in agriculture. The forests are still in timber. The marshlands are still in marshland. And even down to the main transportation routes were very similar to the transportation routes used during Tubman's time. And this really creates an important connection to people. A sense of place creates a very important connection. And that's really what we're going for here in this first exhibit area, is connecting people to these places that were so significant to Tubman's life. We have a number of three-dimensional reconstructed scenes that show important themes to Tubman in this first pavilion, the things that influenced her and really made the values of faith, family, community, and freedom extremely important to Tubman, and shaped her into becoming the successful conductor on the Underground Railroad that she eventually became. Beyond that, we look at a turning point in her life in 1849 when she did decide to leave from Poplar Neck. And again, we use a three-dimensional reconstructed scene there of her at the gate, closing it behind Dr. Anthony Thompson. And she is singing the goodbye song. And this is to alert her friends and family to the fact that she is leaving. We have another area of the exhibit space we like to call the journey, where we have strips of dark blue material hanging from the ceiling with the stars painted on them. And you see the trees' shadows on the floor and the walls around you. And you hear audio track playing with stories that illustrate the skills and characteristics that made Tubman such a successful conductor on the Underground Railroad. We also talk about some of her key rescue missions, the rescue of her parents, the rescue of her three brothers. There's a corn crib. You can actually go inside and listen to that story and hear the rain coming down on the roof of the corn crib. And then, of course, we know that she spent the last half of her life in Auburn, and we certainly want to talk about her work there as well.
By the way, do we know, or do you have any sense about where exactly she was born at this point? Do we have any sense, or is it just a generalized area? And I've been out there, and people have said, well, we think she was born on this area or that area. Do we have any sense at all?
There is some evidence in the form of a receipt to a midwife that indicates she was born near the Madison community.
Okay. And the other thing we should, of course, mention is the fact that not only did she participate in the Civil War, but in the after the Civil War, she clearly became involved with the suffrage movement, worked alongside Susan B. Anthony. Kate, what about that after period in which she began to become involved in the right to vote? And how did that fit into her own sense about what was happening to African Americans at the time? Because they were clearly having a tough time of it, certainly after the end of Reconstruction.
Right. Well, she had been an advocate for women's rights even before the Civil War started. And then because she was very good friends with Susan B. Anthony, Lucretia Mott, Martha Coffin Wright, these early women's rights activists, she, you know, just had an affinity for that, of course. She would want to have rights just like everybody else. But she also was a civil rights activist as well. She had the double burden of being an African-American and a woman, and denied all those rights. So that when, in 1870, when African-American men were given the vote and women of all backgrounds were not given the vote, I know that Tubman must have been furious, because she had been working so hard, and she still was denied those rights. So for the rest of her life, she campaigned for equal rights for women and civil rights for African Americans. And towards the end of her life, she had a lifelong dream fulfilled of opening up a home for aged and sick African Americans. It was like a nursing home and then a home for the aged that she was able to establish, because so many facilities were segregated or there were no facilities available for particularly aging African Americans. So she, you know, fought the battle for the rest of her life to bring dignity, equality, justice, self-determination for all people.
By the way, do you get a sense at studying her whether or not she was disappointed in the lack of progress that was made. I know that, I think it was W.E.B. Du Bois that talked a little bit about this in Black Souls, Souls of Black Folk, that there was a certain disappointment that they had not moved forward enough, that there would have been this hope that there'd be real progress. How does she fit into that discussion?
Of course she was disappointed. She absolutely was disappointed. But she didn't let it stop her. She just kept moving. And if you go to Auburn, New York, where she settled for the last 50 years of her life was very different there than it would have been if she had stayed in Maryland. There were opportunities there that were not available in a southern state. You know, the children of her siblings and her grandchildren and their grandchildren, nieces and nephews, could go to school. The schools were desegregated there. The cemeteries were desegregated. You know, and she was greatly admired and lived in a town that admired her and celebrated her. So her life was different, and she understood that her life was different than what it would have been if she had stayed in Maryland.
Tina Fine, what do you think the significance of Harriet Tubman is, particularly for this region in which a lot of people look upon her as one of the icons, certainly of the Eastern Shore, even though at her time, of course, there were a lot of folks who didn't view that way in terms of the white folks that were here. What kind of importance, what kind of significance do you think she represents for the Eastern Shore?
I think that... I'm an outsider. I live in New England, so when I'm down there, I get a sense of it's like a coming home. Finally, she has the recognition that she deserves. And I know that on the opening of the state park, people were overheard saying things like that they themselves had not been back to the Eastern Shore in 30, 40 years. And they never believed this day would come where Harriet Tubman would be celebrated so magnificently. So it's, you know, it's just, I think it's quite amazing, and it's touching, and it's well-deserved for a woman who really is a great American hero.
And Tina White, what are your final thoughts?
Oftentimes, the children, there are many people that, when you say the name Harriet Tubman, don't know that name, they don't understand that name, and they don't know how it's related. And then some that do know it think about the relevancy of her to today, and she is very relevant in terms of you're looking at the proposed budget cuts and how that's going to hurt a lot of people in the very way that she was trying to uplift people. So in her service to others, you see how relevant that is now. And then in terms of the immigration and what's going on and how I'll never forget this one woman's face that was here for so long. She was just taken and put in the car, and her child was on the outside looking at her, and this look was on her face, and it reminded me of a time when she talked about that was really a catalyst for her to leave, watching her sisters being taken away, torn away from the family. So in that way, and what's going on now is very relevant. How she fought to bring families together and to be a family for those who didn't have family, and to bring her family and keep them together, you know, is very relevant to what's going on now.
This morning we've been speaking with Kate Larson, author of Bound for the Promised Land, Portrait of an American Hero, and Tina Wyatt, the great-great-great-grandniece of Harriet Tubman, and in our studio, Dana Patera, Maryland State Park Manager overseeing the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Visitor Center. This is Don Rush for Delmarva Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.